All right, today, Feast Tabernacles is over. It was over at sundown last night. Yeah, I know. Today is the last day, the eighth day. So it's trying to figure out what should talk about. It was a short subject, and there was two that we haven't talked about a lot. And they're pretty short, so I thought, well, heck, they're both pretty good. Let's go over them. First one, Abigail, before she leaves. Is she still in here? Okay. You get something once. On the at the beginning of the feast, Abigail saw me with this, and she says, "What's that?" And I promised her I'd explain it to her. She wanted to know, what you got that for? So turn your, take your Bibles out and turn to Leviticus 23. And start in verse 40. We're going to read something. It's real short, four verses. It says, "And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit," this is talking about the Feast Tabernacles, it says, "You shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brooks." That's four kinds of trees. The fruit of the beautiful trees, the branches of the palm trees, the boughs of the leafy trees, and the willows of the brook. One, two, three, four. "And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days." So it's kind of strange, isn't it? I mean, here's a verse in the Bible. We're all here because we keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And right in the middle of the verses talking about keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, it says that you've got to take something off of four different kinds of trees and rejoice before the Lord your God, or Yahweh Elohim. You think, man, that's macaroni for us. And I'm kind of leading into the next one. I'm going to talk about macaroni after we talk about this. Because we got to admit, now if you were in Israel and you were there during the feast, you'd see a lot of people walking around with this kind of stuff. Well, not like this. This is what they call non-kosher. See, I'm not from the tribe of Judah, I guess, but I'm still an Israelite because I wanted to get it, you know, I'm cheap. So I bought the non-kosher because it's like half price. I guess, you know, the rabbi hasn't blessed it or whatever, but it fits the requirements. Four different kinds of trees and something from each of the four different kinds of trees. Now, if nothing else, if you couldn't figure out anything else, you say, well, what does that mean, and why does he tell us to do it, and what are we supposed to do it, and how do you use this to rejoice before God? You say, I don't know, because that's what I did the first year I've read it before, but the first year I read it and said, man, what am I supposed to do with this? And I looked at it, and I read it, and I thought about it, and I tried to find where else in the Bible does it talk about this. Are there any examples? You know what the conclusion I came up with? The macaroni I came up with? I don't know. But it says do it, so I better do it. I don't know exactly how you're supposed to use this to rejoice before God, but it says that we're supposed to have this, so at the very least I got to have it. See, because I'm really strange. If it says to do something in the Bible, instead of looking for loopholes, but they used to say, well, that's stupid. God, if you want me to do this, you're going to have to show me why. How many kids are here yet? If mom or dad, Caitlin, if your mom or your dad tell you, Caitlin, I want you to go and do this, whatever it is. And you look at them and you say, that sounds pretty stupid to me. If you want me to do this, you're going to have to explain to me why I'm supposed to do it. How would that go over? Would they like that? No. Would they say, okay, Caitlin, let me sit down and explain this to you. This is why I want you to do this. Or would they say, I told you to do this. Now be a good girl and do it, because there's that famous phrase, because I said so. I used to say, you have to show me, God. But then I learned my lesson, because we had a few of those conversations, and basically he said the same thing to me that I would say to my kids if, you know, I told them when they were young, go do this for me, and they say, well, that's dumb. You're going to have to explain it to me, and it better be good, because if it don't make sense to me, I ain't doing it. So I just ordered it. You know, we've been ordering them for years and years and years. Now, in verse 41, so it said, first of all, in the end of verse 40, it says, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. So does that mean that today we're supposed to be full of sorrow and suffering and pain? And no, but these are supposed to be used for 7 days. In verse 41, it says, you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. So right in the middle of talking about the feast, and we're going to do this forever throughout all of our generations, in the seventh month, you got to have this. Verse 42, you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths. Now this is just sermonette, it's got to be quick. There's a reason, you know, people ask me, you know, well, should we build a booth? Should we sleep in a tent? What should we do? And I basically just refer them back, says, all those who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths. And there's a reason God did that, and it's practical, and it's self-explanatory once you think about it, but we'll go on. We should talk about this another time. Verse 43, that in your generations you may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the children of Israel the feast of the Lord. All right, so does anybody know what a midrash is? Sort of like macaroni. Let me put it in the non-technical East Tennessee vernacular. It's macaroni. You get together and you do a Bible study and you come up with reasons why God, you know, opinions. Works better at like 1, 2, 3 in the morning, but seriously, you know, you look at something and you come up with a reason. Something like this, where there's no real example in the Bible. Now there's hints here and there, don't get me wrong, but nothing clear that says, thus says the Lord, this is how you shall take the four species and rejoice before me. You know, that, nothing like that. Very clear. So gray areas, like Johnny was talking about on one of his talks. There's a midrash or a study that says, they're trying to figure out, what are we supposed to do with this? Now this may or may not be correct. Okay? But it sounds pretty good, so maybe it is. It's not harmful, it's not going to hurt, it's not telling you to do something that goes against God. But if you say, well, that's stupid, I want to know why. Let me give you one possible explanation. Does anybody know what this is? Some of you here have eaten some of it. Yeah, it's an etrog. It's a citrus fruit. It's supposed to be, you know, just citrus. It's native to Israel, and they grow all over. So this is a fruit, a citrus fruit. So think citrus, orange, lemon, things like that. What is it about citrus, as far as physical attributes that a citrus has? Physical attributes are like maybe, when you cut it open, like you're going to eat it, you cut it open and you slice off a piece, what's the first thing that you're going to notice about it if you cut an orange or a lime or a lemon? If you cut it open, what's the first thing you're going to notice about it? It smells. That smell is going to hit your nose and you say, hey, this smells, doesn't smell that bad, it smells kind of nice. And then if you take a piece and you bite into it and you eat it, what's the next thing you're going to notice about it? The taste. people eat citrus because the taste and the smell actually enhances the taste. Companies like McDonald's and Burger King, and they realize that, so they dump chemicals in the food that make them smell more, because if they smell better, they taste better. So this has got both smell and taste. All right? It says, okay, those are the two things we can really figure out about this thing. Now, what does that got to do? How would this have to do with celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles once a year? You know, there's people that have like two different physical attributes to them. You could relate that to both of them. Some people do good things, good deeds. Some people don't, but some people do good deeds. And some people have learning, because this is all regulated to the feast. And celebrating at the feast, there's something God wants from everybody, you know, that would go with it. Good deeds, doing good things for other people, and learning more about God and how to worship Him. Now, let's take the next one. Take this apart, because we don't need it anymore. It says, the palm. Does anybody know what a palm? Oops, losing part of it here. What can you say about a palm tree? Is there anything good that comes from a palm tree? What grows in palm trees? Dates. Okay? So if we're going to look at the dates, it has fruit. The fruit is the date. But it doesn't really have a whole lot of fragrance. Oh yeah, I mean, if you... ain't really a whole lot there. It's got a little bit of a smell to it, but really not much. But it's got a date in there, and the date has what? Taste. It's good. So here you can say if smell and fragrance are good deeds and learning, here the palm, it might have no fragrance, so it lacks good deeds, but it has taste, so it's learning. And it really doesn't matter how you look at, you know, which one is which. It's just an analogy. The myrtle. Let's see, myrtle. Oh, that's just this little guy here. It has fragrance when you smell it. Still smells a little, it's almost dried out and gone, but it's got fragrance, but no taste really. Nothing that grows on it, no fruit, nothing with the taste. So it might have good deeds. Now people, see, we're saying this is just like people. Some people have good deeds, they do good things, but no fragrance, they lack learning, so they don't really get into the Torah, they don't really get into God's Word and study it deep. It doesn't mean they're evil people, it just means that they excel in one area, but not another. Now the willow. This is really kind of interesting. Let me show you what's left of the willow. I got a few of them like this. The willow was the first one to go. The other ones I can still show you, but here's the willow. There's nothing left of it. It's just a stalk. See, the willow doesn't have fragrance and it doesn't have taste. So it has neither good deeds nor learning. It just kind of withered up and died first. It's really kind of interesting when you look at this little analogy here, because at the beginning of the week, it didn't look like this. So what's all this mean? The willow, to those that lack Torah and good deeds, some that lack Learning and good deeds. Some have good deeds and no learning. Some have learning but not good deeds. And some have learning and good deeds together. Doesn't this really paint a picture of God's people? If you really are honest and you look across the masses, this is paints a picture of God's people. Individually, it isn't that great. But if you gather them all together at a celebration that pictures a Messiah returning and setting up his kingdom and preparing the earth for the great resurrection, when all of the people that lived out throughout all time, at the very end of this celebration, are resurrected and they get their chance, and you put them all together, is that something to worship and celebrate God about? So it's a picture of the combination of all people together, all there for the same purpose, to worship God. And it really is representative of all of his people. And that's worth rejoicing about. And I think that's a pretty good explanation. All right. I talked about macaroni. I didn't really come up with this. Several years ago, a friend of mine, Boaz, is the one that was telling me about it. But every American child, when they're growing up in school, they learn about this great American hero. I remember I was in elementary school and they were teaching us about him. Now, I know some of you have heard this before, and I thought about, well, maybe I shouldn't go through it because some of you have heard it before. Maybe others have heard it, not for me, but somebody else. I got thinking and says, no, this is something we all need to think about because it's something we all need to be reminded about. So if you've heard it, just play along, listen, and don't give out the answer for somebody that hasn't heard it before we get to that point. The great American hero that I'm talking about, if you're thinking in the back of your mind, well, who would be this great, famous American hero that every elementary school teaches their children? I'm talking about, this guy was a famous pony rider. He was famous for something that he did on his pony. Now, some of you guys are thinking about maybe Paul Revere or something. It's not him. He's even more famous than that. It's a guy, this hero, his name is Yankee Doodle. Has anybody ever heard of Yankee Doodle? Yankee Doodle. Has anybody not heard of Yankee Doodle? Because then we need to explain it. Arthur. See, he's a great American hero. So they probably don't even talk about him in Eastern Europe. But he was this great American hero. We're going to explain to you what he did. And because this has really got a lot of symbology and euphemisms and things, maybe we'll have to have Israel kind of, I don't know if you can, Johnny tells me when he goes to his in-law's house and they're speaking Spanish and they tell a joke, he asked Dora, what was so funny, because they're all laughing, and he says, forget it, you won't get it. Unless you hear it in Spanish, it's not funny. So maybe this is, you know, unless you understand all the euphemisms and different things, it's not funny. But this famous American hero, he did something. Now, why I say he's famous, because I know there's some people that they kind of shook their head, but they wouldn't raise their hand. Almost everybody in this room has heard of Yankee Doodle. And John said something, he did something dandy. What is it that Yankee Doodle did? Anybody? He stuck a feather in his hat. Okay. And he called it macaroni. See, everybody here knows about it. You say, well, that's stupid. Okay? Pretty bizarre behavior, wouldn't you think? And why would people teach their children something as stupid about somebody riding a pony? Not even a horse, a stallion, or anything. A pony. Taking a feather in his hat and sticking it in his hat and calling it macaroni. Who can understand this nonsense? What does pasta have to do with hats? See, every kid learns a song. Who can sing it with me? Because I don't sing very good by myself. Kind of drawn me out. Every kid learns how to sing this song in school. Who's willing to help me? All right? Are you ready? One, two, three. Yankee Doodle went to town a-riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his hat and called it macaroni. Yankee Doodle. And this song goes on, but everybody here knows. See, Arthur? He's famous. Go to a crowd somewhere, anywhere at Walmart, and stop about, 50 people and say, all right, name anybody else. I don't care who it is. Some of them might have heard of it, but say, his most famous song he ever, about him, and start singing it. And some of the people are going to know it, but, not everybody's going to know it. So this guy's really, he's higher than Elvis. He's higher than John Lennon. He's the most, people just know, this guy's important. Now, why is it important for us to know about Yankee Doodle? Now, here's the other side. When people say, well, what'd you do at the Feast of Tabernacles? Oh, we talked about Yankee Doodle Dandy and macaroni and things like that. And they're going to look and say, well, where did you go? You drove how far to do this? But I think in this book, there's a lot of macaroni. I'm going to explain that to you. When we study stuff in the Bible, some of it makes no sense to us. We're studying it outside of the culture that it was written and practiced in, outside of the language that it was written in, and sometimes when you go from one language to another, there's no perfect way to get there. And it causes some macaroni and some gray areas, and people, they do gyrations, and sometimes there really is just no perfect way to go from one to another. So you've got to kind of do some analogies, but it's always got to be done in the context of what's being said about it, what's the historical surroundings, who's doing it, where are they when they're doing it. And sometimes we don't take all of these things into account when we're looking at this macaroni stuff in the Bible. And what happens when you do that? You come to obscure passages that are difficult, and it's hard to find other things that relate with it and kind of explain it, like the four species, and that's really why I put the two of these together. And you're trying to come to a conclusion because you want to understand, and your heart is right, and your motivation is right. And so you say, well, what could this mean, and what do you think this means, and does it fit in with other things that talk about this in the Bible? But ultimately, they're conclusions. They're macaroni. So sometimes people, they get together and they study and they look and they research and they dig and they try and figure out who said it, where did they say it, what was the context, what the time was, what were the people involved in. And then they pray, which is a good thing. But sometimes when we really, 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 really want to know something and we're praying, sometimes, not always, don't get me wrong, but sometimes we don't just let God tell us. We got something we would like it to be or what we think it is, and we come to these conclusions. Other times, people hear something in the back of their mind, and maybe it's God, and maybe it's not. You think that the devil sometimes tries to whisper things in your ear that would cause you to go astray? I guarantee you he does. So we got to be sure who it is talking to us. But ultimately, people on the macaroni aspects of the Bible, they pray, they get an answer, and they are convinced in their own mind it's from God. And then they come out with a statement that says, I was in deep prayer and God's Spirit came upon me and this is the answer. And I have the knowledge that nobody else has been able to figure about, and I'm special. I'm forming my own group and we're meeting here. And oh, by the way, I've applied for 501c3 and mark all your checks out to tithe because we're now a church of the state of, such and such, formed under the corporate laws of America and granted power to exist by the authority on high in Washington, D.C. But anyway, And I'm taking an extreme on this, but you know, when people are serious and they're praying and they come up with an answer, sometimes it's the right answer, and sometimes it's not the right answer. But the cautionary thing we got to do is we've got to realize this isn't really clear. Now, we think we figured it out. You can do things like this on what's a subject that a lot of us have had to face, and some of you are even here because of this reason. You could do something like this on a subject like the calendar. I mean, if you ask me, it's so clear. I mean, you can't get out of Genesis without understanding the calendar if you look at everything else. But to other people, it's like, what are you going to do with Romans 3? Dumb oracles. You know, that's what got me for a whole year. Unto the Jews is given the oracles of God. I didn't know what the heck the oracles of God were, but it sounded really authoritative to me. So yeah, they do it. They got the calendar. Until somebody says, did you ever look up, see what the oracles of God meant? No. So to some people it can be very clear one way, and to other people it can be very clear the other way. But I'm going to be the first one to stand here and tell you, the calendar is macaroni. There's only one right way to cook that pasta, but you got to have some love and compassion in your heart, and you got to have patience, and you got to be willing to look at it no matter what side of the fence you're at. And this is like this for so many other things in the Bible. What about what night do you do Passover? What night do you wash feet? What night do you have the unleavened bread? Do you have it at the beginning of the 14th? Or do you have it at the end of the 14th? People on both sides of this have very, very strong issues. There's a fellow one year, we were at the Feast of Tabernacles about 15 years ago. He found out I didn't keep Passover on the same night he kept it. He come up to me and he says, we won't be here anymore. I said, why? He says, because I heard that you're keeping Passover on the wrong night. You know what I said to him? I said, this is the Feast of Tabernacles. What does Passover have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? And you don't keep Passover with us anyhow. Never have. But that was it. For several years, I didn't see or hear about him at all. And he was somebody that I wasn't a close friend, but I knew him. We had got together. I'd been to his house. But we couldn't keep the Feast of Tabernacles together because we didn't agree what night was the correct night for Passover. That's macaroni to the extreme. Where's the love? Where's the compassion? What if he was wrong and he forced me to do it his way? Well, first he couldn't. If you can force somebody to go along with you, I guess if you got enough pressure or sway over them. But are you going to really convince them? Is that what God wants? If somebody looks at a subject and they study it and they ask God for help and they come to a conclusion and he lets them come to that conclusion, who are you to go in and smash them? Nothing wrong with saying, can we look at this again? Can we study this again? Can we do it in love? Can we do it in compassion? If somebody asks you why it is you do what you do, you should always have an answer. This is what I think. But you know what? Your answer shouldn't be, well, those stupid people over there that do it the wrong way, they're so ignorant, they don't even, don't let them trick you. If your answer starts out like that, your answer is coming from Satan. I'm just going to be honest with you. That's where it's coming from. Where's the love? How many people did Jesus study with in the synagogue, as his custom was, that he agreed with 100% doctrinally? He was the only one there that was right. Everybody else was wrong, including his parents on things, I'm sure. Now, when they really crossed the line and they said, this was Yeshua. He was able. He didn't do it to the people, but he did come to the religious leaders and say, you vipers, you snakes. He could see into their heart. He knew their motivations. He knew why they did what they did. But the people, how did he treat them? Love. compassion. Yes, he knew something they didn't know. And if they asked them, he would tell them. Notice he didn't grab them by the corner or the collar of their rope, drag them across the street, put them in the corner of a building where they couldn't go. They were trapped in, and he sat there like this. He says, now you are going to sit there, and you're going to listen to this until you get it. Show me chapter and verse where he did that. But yet we think we can do that in God's church. Well, maybe not that extreme always, but let me pull my spiritual sword out and do battle with you. The result is the same. There's dead bodies and blood and corpses all over the place. Over macaroni. Now I'm going to get to this macaroni. See, we can do things. You could make a doctrine out of Yankee Doodle. Everybody knows about them. It's famous. Everybody knows the song. So you could say, this is how I interpret the macaroni. What does it mean? See, some preachers, they could get together and they could expound on the Yankee Doodle Dandy text. They could give us a sermon on the revolutionary soldiers and how they were so hungry that they imagined their hats were food. They were starving to death. So they would picture their hats were food, macaroni, before they ate them. And they would tell us that this is how the expression, I'll eat my hat, came into being. Whole denominations could be built on differing views, like hat eating. Just go with me for a minute here. There would be some that insist that hat eating be done every single week. There would others who proclaim that it's only symbolic, and maybe you should do it every 26 weeks or every quarter or once a month or once a year. You know, look at those stupid people that eat their hats every week when they know that the Yankee Doodle only did this on one day of the year and this is to commemorate that day. So you'd have all of these schisms and divisions and everything else. Here's another one. I think we could split the group in two. What if you said that half of the people said that the hat literally becomes macaroni, transubstantiates into macaroni as you eat it. It's a hat when you stick it in your mouth, but once it enters your body, it literally becomes macaroni. And the other half would claim that it only represents macaroni. You could split a group up over that alone. Churches have split up over things dumber than that. People have, think about this in history for a minute, those that know a little bit about it, people have been murdered over a subject called transubstantiation. Is the bread that you take and the wine that you drink, is that literally Jesus' body and blood, or does it simply represent it? Well, if you don't believe it, well, once there's a majority and a certain amount of people think this way, and if you didn't believe it and proclaim it, they killed you. It's like Ahmed the terrorist, if anybody watches Jeff Dunham. I kill you! That's what they did. Each side would claim that the other side were nothing but heretics, or ignorant, or unlearned, or unqualified, or worshiping Satan. You know what? In that example, maybe both sides are wrong. In Yankee Doodle's day, macaroni had nothing to do with pasta. That's the key to the whole thing. We do the same thing with the Bible today. We're 2,000-3,000 years or more in some instances removed from the context of what's written in the Bible. The culture. We've never been in it. We don't know anything about it. And some people go over to a culture today, a modern culture, and they say, oh, this is what it was like 3,000 years ago, so this explains everything. I went to Israel, I know. Let me see here. If you go to New York City today, can you assume what it was like in New York City 150 years ago? And say, well, I've been there. I've ridden the subways of Manhattan. I know. It's got nothing. You know. I've seen pictures of New York City 50 years ago. And I wouldn't be able to tell you, even though I've been to, you know, New York, take a picture of Atlanta 50, 75 years ago, you go through Atlanta, everybody knows what you could drop. Some people say, oh yeah, this is Atlanta, I know where this. Give them a picture 75 years ago and ask them where they are. Talk to people and their way of life and how they do things today versus 75 years ago. Now go 3,500 years ago and tell me you're an expert just because you've been to Atlanta or New York. It takes more than that. Our culture is totally different today. It changes. Man, it changes. Think about if you are 50 years or older, think about, you could do the same thing for 20, but it's much more dramatic. If you're 50 years or older, think about what it was like when you were a child, and society and values and growing up. It's done a 180 degree turn in the last 15 years, but compared to what it was, it's nothing this even close. So it's macaroni. So I'm going to give you the definition, the old English definition of macaroni. Like I said, it's not pasta. I'm going to read it to you. It's a fancy, dandyish style of gentleman's attire, a style of Italian clothing widely imitated in England in the 18th and the 19th century. So Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his hat, and called it a fancy, dandyish style of gentleman's attire. That makes sense. It was a style of clothing. It was macaroni. It was dandy. See how simple these things are? And see how bad we can screw them up when we put our own interpretations on them? Now, if you want to study, you want to come to conclusions, that's okay. But don't make dogma and doctrine and persecute and look down on and chastise somebody else because they came to a different conclusion or have a little bit different understanding and they're not causing trouble saying, let's eat our hat and see if it turns into macaroni or not, or if it only represents macaroni. They're just there to worship and to love God, and they prayed and they asked Him, and this is what God allowed them to come to that conclusion for this time right now. And we don't see it eye to eye. And we don't agree on every little point. And hardly anybody knows what macaroni really is today unless you look it up. Thank you.